All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you here from New York City on the 20th day of February, 2018. I always like to remind you that I'm the editor of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, which you can subscribe to at miningstocks.com, miningstocks.com, on call our office in New York during normal work hours at 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. Also like to encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, chenpicks.com. Chen has done exceptionally well over the years, taking $5,400 in his in an IRA account and without any new money going into it, causing that account to rise to $2.5 million over a 10-year period. So it's his track record is remarkable, not only there, but in other accounts that he's managed. So, Chen Lin, it's chenpicks.com. I want to thank each of you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. Also, encourage you to send your questions, criticisms, praises, comments, what have you, to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. We do want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for today's show, RN Resources, Dynacore Gold Mines, Genesis Metals Corp, New Range Gold Corp, Northern Empire Resources, Novo Resources, and Uranium Energy. I've titled today's show, Return of the Bond Vigilantes. What does it mean for the markets? Our main guest this week was supposed to be David Stockman, but because of an emergency that arose for him late today, I will be interviewing him on Friday and hope to have that interview posted at Jay Taylor Media on Saturday. So we'll talk to David about the Bond Vigilantes on Friday, and we'll send you out an email to let you know when it is posted at Jay Taylor Media. If you're not on our email list, send a request to be put on the list. Go to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Fortunately, I was able to have John Rubino join me today in the second half of today's show. He'll be discussing the bond vigilantes and his views of the stock, bond, and commodity markets as well. Here is the issue that the Treasury is faced with. The U.S. is running huge deficits. Got to finance them somehow. It's lowered the interest rates below the market levels, and who wants to buy treasuries? Well, they're finding there's a mismatch between the demand and the supply because the markets are not allowed to, or the markets have not been allowed to price capital, and so the rates have to rise. It seems that that's the case. When David Stockman was the budget advisor to President Reagan back in the early 1980s, the U.S. deficit was about $1 trillion, a little less than that. Now it's exploding to over $20 trillion and rising even more rapidly under Donald Trump, the way it looks anyway. And at this point in time, not even the Tea Party Republicans are too concerned about holding the deficit down. Everyone seems to be spending money like drunken sailors in Washington. But who is going to buy the U.S. debt? That's the big key. And today alone, I read there's $179 billion of treasuries has to be funded. By the end of this week, $258 billion. The Fed has backed away from quantitative easing, and countries like China, Japan, and others that had been enabling us to live beyond our means for so many years are backing away, seemingly, at least especially Japan in the last few months has backed away from the U.S. Treasury market. So obviously the rate of interest will have to rise to find an equilibrium point if the U.S. is going to raise the capital that it needs to expand its empire and to finance socialism here. And, after all, we're in 160 different countries around the world expanding the empire. It costs money. Ultimately, empires in the past have fallen when they've gone beyond what they were able to do. We'll see what happens. The bottom line is that something here is going to have to give. Will the new chairman of the Fed, Jay Powell, give in and start printing money like Greenspan, Bernanke, and Yellen have before him? Or will he actually pull a Paul Volcker and put his foot on the brakes and not allow new money to be created, allow interest rates to find new equilibrium? That's not fathomable to me and to others that I've spoken to. How can interest rates rise so dramatically when there is so much debt, and just a little bit of increase in debt increases the amount of treasuries that have to be borrowed simply to pay the debt, the interest on the debt? So it's going to be interesting to watch, that's for sure. And, of course, really pleased to have Eric Coffin's going to be joining me after the first commercial break today to give his views on the markets, but also some of his top picks, the things that he's looking at. He is really an exploration expert, and so we'll be talking to Eric Coffin. But right now, I'm really pleased to have Michael Oliver with me to give not his opinions, his gut feel, but basically the results of his labor, his work, that objectively look at markets. And I think that's one of the big advantages that Michael brings. Not only is it objective, but it's been so darn accurate. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you here. You know, the U.S. Treasury, as I just mentioned, is borrowing huge amounts of money, and so the rates are rising. You put out a very interesting article today, again, talking about the Judas Goat. Talk to us about Judas Goat and what that's all about, and how are you seeing the bond markets now?
Well, back in 1987, I recall, this is 5 years before I founded Momentum Structural Analysis, I caught the crash, and it was based on my analysis of quarterly momentum of the S&P at the time. But during that time, something very interesting was going on that I always remembered. And that was that the bond market was going down, yields were going up. Uh-huh. And it was doing it in a persistent and fairly steep way. And the stock market was ignoring it, ignoring it, until finally the bonds just put their foot to the pedal on the downside, and then the S&P just crashed. And bonds rallied, I think, at 10 or 20 points in a few days. Yields dropped back down. But the bonds were just determined to take the stocks to slaughter. And I use the phrase Judas goat, which is a goat that has a purpose to lead the other goats this way or that way, in this case to the downside. Now, if you'll recall, the S&P dropped over 200 points on February 5th and the 6th, early this month. And that 200-point drop, the bonds turned and rallied 4 points. Mm-hmm. But then when the stocks turned back up, the bonds said, oh, okay, not enough, huh? And so bonds went back down and made new lows. Now, they're not making new lows at a sharp or precipitous rate, but they're persistent in the downside. And they keep looking over their shoulder at stocks, and as long as stocks stay steady, I think the bonds are going to stay on the floor. And if need be, I think the bonds, the Judas Goat, will have another leg of decline here. I think ultimately we're going into the 120s on T-bond futures, which are now in the low 140s. That's about a 4.25% yield, by the way, if we get there. But every time the stocks look like, oh, man, we're going to hang in here, the bonds say, okay, I'm back on the floor again. And I think that it's behaving like a Judas goat, and I think it's bound and determined to get to whatever level it takes to bring the stock market back down again, and this time to get it down, from a lower high than the prior high. And so I think there's sort of a duel going on there. So we're watching bonds very closely here to see if there's not another 3 to 5 point drop that can precipitate another S&P sell-off. If it does that, I think the bonds will get a nice little short-term rally, probably very sharp, as a relief rally, a counter-trend rally.
Sure.
It won't change the direction of rates. It'll just give some relief. But that's what I think is going on with bonds right now, is they're watching stocks, and that's what they're keying off of, with the determination to bring stocks down.
Right. What about gold and treasury rates and interest rates? So, there was a period of time, I'm old enough to remember it very vividly, in the 1970s and 1980s, all the way up until, most of the time since 1971 until about 2006 or so, higher interest rates correlated with higher gold prices. That hasn't seemed to be the case now. So when we get higher rates, people are expecting gold to go down. Today it was down, 15, 20 bucks or so on higher rates with this big treasury demand. What are your thoughts on gold relative to interest rates?
Well, if you look at bonds, though, from a broader point of view, if you go back to mid-2016, when T-bond futures were at 176, okay, we're now at 143. Gold was at 1050. It's now at 1320s, 1330.
Yeah, that's right.
So in the bigger perspective, it's they are moving opposite. As bonds go down and yields go up, gold is rising.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, in the real short term, yes, I agree. There's some days in here where it looks like bonds and gold are behaving the same. And I think to some extent that the gold market is looking for the next shaking of investor confidence in stocks, because I think it'll get the benefit of that. Because gold is, after all, yes, we're down $20 today, but we're down $20 or so, which is a couple percent off the high of the last 2 to 3 years, which was the highest trade of the last 2 to 3 years was 1370 something. So we got up at the 1360 a week ago, and right now we're 1320. So we're several percent off the highs of the last several years. So it's not that bad. We're not at 1180. Okay. It's a bit confusing because the short term sometimes can make you think there's a correlation one way. In fact, when you stand back and look at a year, year and a half's worth of action, you see that, in fact, it's the other way. As rates go up, gold has been going up.
Very good point, Michael. With just a couple of minutes left, we had one listener asking about natural gas. I know you're generally bullish on the commodities in spite of rising rates, but what do you what are your thoughts on natural gas if you have some?
Of the energy sector, if I had to pick one that had the greatest potential for percent gain from current levels. Now remember, oil's had a big move over the last year and a half. Just above $3, and I won't get real specific about the number we do in our reports.
Sure.
You can close out a month at a certain level above $3. I think you could shoot natural gas up to $4.50. Now, $4.50 historically is not all that high either for natural gas, but that's a 50% move. So, yes, we're watching natural gas. Our prime focus right now is on the grains. We think the grains are in unison, ready to explode. But natural gas in the energy sector looks like the potential for the biggest percentage gain over a short period of time, assuming it can cross the hurdle. And we've defined the hurdle, and we're watching it closely.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just make a note here that on this day when most asset prices are getting clobbered, the grains, many of them quite strong, and I see the meats are very strong in the futures markets today as well.
The meats is another area that we think is ready. The food commodities are going to lead this year in the commodity sector, with the possible exception of gold. But oil's had a big move for the last year and a half, so is copper. We tend to think, well, they'll continue firm. They're not going to be the leaders anymore. Leadership will shift to food commodities.
All right. Very interesting. Well, thanks again, Michael, for being with us. And always a pleasure talking to you and getting your insights into these markets. Well, folks, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away because Eric Coffin will be with me. He's one of the best there is at picking early stage exploration stocks. If you want to make a lot of money percentage-wise in the junior mining sector, if you can latch on to the right early exploration stocks, that's where you make it. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Eric Coffin.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
New Range Gold Corps is a Canadian junior explorer focused on its recently acquired flagship Pamlico Gold Project, located in Nevada, one of the best mining jurisdictions in the world. Known as one of Nevada's highest grade gold districts, Pamlico was held by private interests for most of its history and remains largely unexplored. Drilling by New Range is already confirming the legendary grades of the district with intercepts up to 341 grams gold per ton. Well-financed with no debt, New Range is unlocking shareholder value at Pamlico and trades under TSX symbol NRG.
Orin Resources is a Canadian-based gold exploration company focused on the company's flagship Committee Bay project, located in northern Canada, one of the best mining jurisdictions in the world. The company's current resource, outlined by drilling thus far, stands at 1.1 million ounces of gold at over 8 grams per ton. Orin is operated by the same team that founded Asanko Gold, which is constructing a major gold mine in West Africa, and Caden Resources, which was recently purchased in November for over $200 million.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really glad to have with me once again a friend of mine, Eric Coffin. I've known Eric for many years. He not only brings an exceptional level of integrity with him, but he also has a huge amount of experience in analyzing the prospects of early stage exploration projects. And that's important because if you can pick the stocks that have great upside potential when they are selling for a few pennies, the upside, at least in terms of percentage terms, it can be phenomenal. So Eric is as good as anyone I know at picking early stage stories. So, and he's also the co-founder of the Metals Investor Forum, which is held several times a year in Vancouver. This year, for the first time, it will be in Toronto, right before the PDAC. And I will be attending that, speaking there and inviting a few of my favorite companies there. And Eric, of course, will also be there with some of his favorite picks. So I suggest that if you're around the PDAC and can go there, it's on Saturday, the day before the PDAC starts, that you go to Jay Taylor Media or miningstocks.com, click on the link, on the Metals Investor Forum link, and register, because these things tend to sell out, and then sometimes there's not enough chairs for all of the people that want to sit down. So go to Jay Taylor Media, Mining Stocks, and sign up for the Metals Investor Forum. It's going to be held at the Delta Hotel in Toronto. That's very close to the convention center where the PDAC is being held. Eric, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me again, Jay. And your advice on the RSVPing is good, because the list for MIF is starting to get fairly full. So those that want to attend, you probably don't want to wait too long to make sure your name's on the list, because we do normally end up closing that list in advance of the event.
Yeah, and I imagine with the PDAC and all that, there's probably a lot of latecomers too. So it's shaping up well, and you've got to have, what, about 20, how many companies will be there about?
Matt squeezed in as many as he could. I think it's close to 20. I mean, it's going to be
on a one-day event. It's just
really
a one
long day, but we are going to feed you, and we are going to give you free alcohol at the end to kind of help take away the pain. So
we hope there's not too much pain. We hope there's some gain. Although today the markets are a little bit difficult. I think there's something you called the PDAC curse in the past. It's been sort of, I guess the markets have been kind of weak right after that early March event, the biggest mining show, I think, probably in North America. Am I right about that, Eric?
Oh, it's in the world. I mean, the PDAC.
In the world, even, yeah.
Oh, yeah, by far. The PDAC, the normal registration these days for PDAC is about 25,000 people. It's a big show.
Yeah, it is huge. It's absolutely huge. And it's a can't-miss show if you're in this business, that's for sure. Well, today the U.S. government is going to market, it's in the process, I guess, of marketing $179 billion of treasuries. It's got to raise that amount of money in the markets, and by the end of the week, $258 billion needs to be raised. So what are your thoughts about the macroeconomic picture now in light of that, Eric? And, you know, rates have to go up in order to attract the capital, especially since the Fed isn't printing money anymore, and especially since some countries like China, and especially more recently Japan, is pulling back for its own reasons from Treasury. So how do you think that's going to impact the things that you and I follow so closely, our gold shares, for example?
Well, you know, we went through this long period where there was there was enough uncertainty and enough, as they euphemistically call it in Washington, excess savings overseas,
yeah.
Some of which are being, like you said, are being pulled back now, that it seemed no matter what the Fed printed, they never really had a lot of trouble selling these things. And I think you've got two things going on at the same time, or at least I think there are, that are making things a little more difficult. One is we're starting to see concerns about inflation again. I'm not yet completely sold on that, although I agree it's probably going to come up a little bit this year at least. Maybe it accelerates, but right now I don't expect to see a big move in inflation. But when you've got 10-year rates at 2.8%, inflation doesn't have to move much for those rates to get pulled right along with it.
Right.
The other thing happening, as you mentioned, is supply. And I mean, I was surprised, we just went through a correction, which I'm not convinced is over on the S&P. And part of what drove that was inflation concerns. But I wondered myself at the time how much of it was guys on the bond market saying, let's look at this new tax cut thing that just got passed. Let's look at this infrastructure plan that Trump's going to try to push through now. It's, the deficits in Washington are going to be very large. And that's based on, that's based on the OMB scoring, which I think is a farce. Anyone outside of Washington thinks it's a farce. No one really expects them to pull off the slow deficit reduction that's outlined in that plan. I think anybody outside of Washington expects those deficits to go the other way and just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think the bond market's starting to get a little worried about, who's going to eat all this supply. And I think on top of that, you had this burst of enthusiasm as the tax cuts were passed and everybody was going, the economy is accelerating, everything's fantastic. But I'm sure you saw the last couple of big, or what I consider the last couple of big metrics out of the U.S., and the one that really got my attention was not the CPI, which was the slight increase that was expected. What really got my attention was the retail sales, which was terrible. The retail sales report was horrible.
That's right.
It went from expectations of a reasonable, like a 0.3% growth in sales, and ended up being negative, but more to the point, the December one, that was a really strong report initially. They got everybody excited. That one also was taken back to zero. And the core retail sales rate, the one that's actually used in the GDP calculation, that one went from being, I think, positive 0.3 to negative 0.2. So that's kind of lost. That basically comes right out of the GDP calculation. So I'm thinking now, this acceleration everybody was talking about, I'm not so sure that acceleration is going to happen.
Yeah.
And my concern, and I think the reason in my mind why we're not seeing those sales increases is we're not really seeing as they like to call it in Washington during the 80s, we're not seeing the trickle down yet. Like the 1% got all these big tax cuts and stuff, but unless that trickles down and your average Joe or Jane sees these wage increases, where's the retail sales coming from? Most of the U.S. economy is consumer spending, and if the income growth isn't being generated, where's the growth come from? That's 70% of the economy right there.
Right.
You're not getting consumption growth. I don't see where this acceleration is going to come from.
Well, I guess there's some hope that the tax cuts will help a little bit, but I agree with you, Eric. I think very tepid, and that should really bode well for a more accommodative monetary policy, you would think. But on the other hand, when the deficit and the red ink runs so deep, the deficit does have to be financed, at least to an extent. It has to be financed one way or another, else people are going to start losing confidence in the currency, and then you're in really big trouble. So it's going to be interesting, that's for sure. But let's turn to a couple of your favorites, Ademir Minerals. I mean, in a day in which most of the juniors are not doing all that well, it's performing pretty well, and I think on the back of some apparent good news, or at least a drill intercept or so that was reported last week, that looks like it could be really good news. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I mean, Ademir is a company I've followed for a while. They started a new drill program a couple of weeks ago. This was a target, because the target's called SE1, and SE just stands for Southeast. It's in the Southeast portion of their holdings. This target was the strongest anomaly that was generated by this big geophysical airborne survey they flew over a year ago. Mark Kolobaba, who's the geo and the CEO of Atomera, he's always loved this target. It just took him forever and a day to get drill permitting from the U.S. Forest Service. He does have it now, and it appears that they're very accommodative after having thrown up roadblocks for a year. So they finally managed to get a drill on that. They reported the first hole last week, and there's no assays. I believe they just finished sending samples from this hole in, so we probably won't see assays for a week or two. But it was significant enough that he felt he had to put out something. And what he hit with his drill hole was roughly 120 meters of semi-massive to massive sulfides and silica flooding. He sent me a bunch of core pictures. It's beautiful core. I mean, it's the type of thing that it's very easy to get jacked up about this. The one caveat I will tell people is that this is a gold property. This is not an area, and this is not a mineralization style where you're going to see any gold. The only way you're going to find out whether it's got gold in it is to send it to the lab, which is where it is now. So maybe this has got gold, maybe it isn't. But what's got people excited is, one, the scale of it. 120 meters is a very thick intercept. I talked to Mark this morning. He's going to have a release out in an hour or two, but the next release he's putting out is something he's been threatening to put out for a month, which is a sort of a what I did in my summer vacation release. Because the thing's been slow with the permitting and everything. I think his shareholders got frustrated, and I said, you know, you should put out a release and just walk through everything you did, because they were actually really busy. They did a huge amount of work and advanced a lot of targets. This is only one. But I think this is a really good drill speculation. I don't know if there's any gold in this hole. If there is, with that kind of an intercept, the stock's going to go crazy. But more to the point, this is not the only target they're drilling. This drill phase, they should be drilling three or four different targets. And a couple of the other ones, one of them is called Key West. Another one's called Overlook. Those targets that they're drilling are either direct extensions of zones that were mined in the past, or on-trend extension of the zones that were mined in the past, where they don't know it's the same zone, but they're pretty sure it is. That was simply never tested in the past. So I don't think there's very little chance that these guys are going to strike out in this drill phase. They're going to get a couple of good drill holes. What I'm hoping is they get a couple of good drill holes and a great drill hole here. They have apparently just finished the second hole at this SE1 target. I think we'll see some reporting on that in a couple of days. But again, it's not going to be assays. It's going to be, this is what it looked like and this is what it means. But the comment that I got from Mark was, he thinks Martin St-Pierre, the geophysicist, he said, I'm pretty sure Mark was very accurate with his dip measurement on this zone before we drilled it. And what that means is this 120-meter intercept is probably actually pretty close to true width. They didn't drill down something. They were going to drill perpendicular, and he said, I think it was pretty much perpendicular to the zone. So it's a big zone.
Well, it's certainly 120 meters, and if it's mineralized with anything significant at all, I think this stock could really, really fly. There's only, well, there are 125 million shares, but it's selling at, I think, around 18 cents Canadian today. It's up a little bit in a bad market, $23 million market cap. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under the symbol DDNEF, and in Toronto, ADZ. And, this is a stock that's actually doubled over the last couple of months, Eric, in a market that hasn't been all that good. So I think this is a typical Eric Coffin play, folks, and pay attention to what he has to say. Eric, we have time for one more today. San Marco is another one that I bought, thanks to your recommendation. Trades in Toronto, SMN, SMREF in the States, 66.3 million shares, 19 cents earlier today in Canadian money. 12.6 million market cap. Also a baby, but really some, I think, tremendous upside potential here. A huge anomaly that they're finding there in Mexico, right? At least on one of their properties.
Yeah. Well, they actually have two separate areas on properties that are, adjacent to each other, essentially.
Yeah.
One is called 1068. That's a porphyry target. Porphyries are big, low-grade, copper, gold, moly systems. Most of the world's copper gets mined out of porphyry deposits. They found this thing, and it's a new discovery. Nobody knew about this before they came along. They found this last year, and what they initially found was what's called a lithocap, and that's the lithocap is just this alteration zone that sits on top of these systems, mm-hmm. and it normally doesn't have much in it itself. It's fairly dead. Geologists can recognize that it's a lithocap, but they don't know really what's under it. They did manage to find, rooting around, literally, in and out of the arroyos, they found a couple of spots where the underlying phyllic zone, and the phyllic zone is what's, that's normally where the ore is in one of these systems. They did actually find a couple of spots where it poked out of the ground. They got nice grades there. They got like 0.5, 0.6, 0.7 copper, 0.2, 0.3 gold, which is high for that region. What I'm expecting to see, you know, imminently, because I know it's done and I know they got the report, but we should see a report out like any time now on an IP survey. IP is induced polarization. It's the system that was actually designed to find porphyries. And what they're trying to find is a nice big chargeability anomaly, and it's the sulfides, the chalcopyrite and the pyrite sort of lights these things up. I assume that the geophysicists will have said, you know, based on my survey, I think you should drill here, here, and here. I'm sure these guys have their own ideas. I know there's been at least three or four major companies on this property in the last month or two. Like, they're getting a lot of interest from majors. They do have the money to drill it themselves. It's either going to be drilled by them or by one of these majors, I think, fairly soon, because there's really nothing else to do now. It's basically ready to go. The property next door called Cunabah, they found this new zone like a month ago, very weird, relatively high copper grades and silver at surface. They've taken a whole bunch of grab samples off of outcrops. There's not lots of outcrops sticking out, but they sampled what they could. I'm expecting a couple of things on that one. Bob said they did have crews in there trying to find larger outcrop areas where they could do longer samples and at least give people some kind of, you know, this much over X meters. There should be a bunch of that in the lab. That should be coming soon. The closest thing I can find to this deposit type or what this looks like is it's what's called a manto. And this isn't a manto deposit, but there's things like this in South America. There's several of them in Chile. They were sort of the copper deposit type before porphyries came along. And these deposits range from 30, 40, 50 million tons, but they're usually like about 1% copper, and they've usually got a bunch of silver in them. I mean, they're nice deposits. And there's a bunch of other stuff going on in Cunabah, too. I mean, there's a lot of targets on these two properties. They do have the money to drill. Bob told me last week they still have $1.5 million in the bank. So either San Marco or a major or probably both will be drilling both of these things in the next month or two. And both of these are targets that have the potential to deliver, you know, really big holes. And porphyries, when you make a porphyry discovery, where you really want to be there is during the first drill phase, because when they report the first, you know, multi-100-meter intercepts, that's when a company exploring a porphyry really goes nuts.
Right, right. So anyway, we're just basically out of time. I know we wanted to talk about Silvercrest Metals as well. 54.7 million shares of stock trading. It's about a buck or so. I can't remember exactly what the price is. Another one. How much, Eric?
It's closer to two.
$2, yeah, in Canadian money. So another one that you like a lot. We unfortunately don't have time to talk about it today, but Eric, your website where people can go to sign up for your letter is HRA. What is it now? I forgot to write it down.
HRAAdvisory.com.
Folks, do yourself a favor and go there. Learn about it. It's a very reasonably priced letter and a lot of great ideas. We should have Eric on the show more often because I buy a lot of things that Eric recommends because I know the good work he does, and he puts a lot of his heart and soul and a lot of sweat into these things. So,
and you're still talking to me.
Well, no, I've done very well with your stocks, Eric, and I'm very pleased with it. So thanks again for joining us, and we do need to do it more often. I look forward to seeing you up there in Toronto as well.
Yeah, we should, yeah. Yeah, don't forget, Jay's one of the presenters at MIF, and that's reason enough to fly up all by itself.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe for some people. Well, thanks, Eric, and thanks for that, and we'll look to see you in Toronto and have you back again soon. Folks, don't go away. John Rubino is going to be with me, and he'll replace David Stockman, who was not able to be here, unfortunately, today. But John will be with me right after the break, so don't go away.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdies Reward Project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia. Uranium Energy Corp. NYSE Market, UEC, is a leader in the coming bull market in uranium, with spot uranium up more than 40% in 2 months. The new bull market is just starting. UEC has the cash, the licensed resources, the permitted processing center, the advanced technology, and the experienced team to lead this market. Get to know this exciting company now by visiting UraniumEnergy.com. NYSE Market, UEC.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am pleased to have with me once again John Rubino. John runs the popular financial website dollarcollapse.com. He's the author with Gold Money's James Turk on a book called The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops. He's written many other books as well, and he is an author, writes for some prestigious prestigious publications such as TheStreet.com. He's also writes for the CFA magazine and other such prestigious publications. Thank you for joining me again, John.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Good to be back, and thank you so much for stepping in. I was so grateful to you for being able to take David Stockman's place today, and also thanks so much for hosting my show a couple of weeks ago. It allowed me to make a trip to Nevada and visit a very interesting gold mining project there. So thanks very much for all of that. You know, we've titled today's show, Return of the Bond Vigilantes, What Does It Mean for the Markets? And maybe we'd just like to ask you to define a bond vigilante and what purpose do they serve?
Well, sure. Back in normal times, which is to say pre-1990s, the bond market was kind of a limiting factor on financial mismanagement on the part of governments, because once governments started borrowing too much money or encouraging their citizens to borrow too much money, the people who would normally buy bonds would lose their interest in something that that pays a fixed number of pieces of currency year after year, because the assumption would be that all this debt that's being taken on by the rest of the country would make the currency less valuable. You know, we'd have to create a lot of new dollars to pay off all the interest on the new debt we're taking on. And that would make the bond market skittish. Bond prices would go down, interest rates would go up, and that would stop the aggressive leveraging of the government in its tracks. That stopped in the 1990s when we were taking on huge amounts of debt, mostly via the dot-com bubble at the time, and the Fed was still intervening aggressively to stop any kind of a little incipient crisis in the market. They did it over and over again, right. And by doing so, they sent the market a message that don't worry, go ahead and keep buying bonds because the central bank is going to keep pushing interest rates down no matter what. And so we had a stretch of 30-some years since the 80s to basically last year in which interest rates went down every year. And so the bond vigilantes were basically hamstrung. The bond uh-huh. market was no longer a limit on the amount of debt that a system could take on. And, you know, surprise, surprise, we took on immense amounts of debt while that was going on. You know, once we didn't have any adult supervision from the bond market, yeah. the rest of the economies of the world, and it's not just the U.S., it's all the major economies of the world, took on unprecedented, one would say crazy amounts of debt, which, you know, puts us where we are now in a situation where we're so fragile that any kind of a crisis, whether it's exogenous, you know, some kind of geopolitical thing, or within the markets, a garden variety bear market in equities where they drop 20%, anything like that is systemically threatening now. And that should be terrifying to everybody who has money at risk, because, you know, you get stuff like that every once in a while. There will be a war. I'll go out on a limb and say there will be a really scary war in the next decade, and that there will be extreme fluctuations in the financial markets this year, as we're seeing already, and going forward. You know, and that kind of stuff used to be something that the markets could handle. Probably not anymore. And so that's a huge change if you've got any money at risk, because now it's really at risk.
John, how is it that the U.S. could behave that way, that the central banks around the world could behave that way? How is it that they have been able to defy the natural laws of supply and demand for money? How is it that confidence has been maintained when you've had U.S. deficit for the U.S. debt, for example, going up from somewhere less than $1 trillion when David Stockman was with Ronald Reagan in 1980 to $20 trillion and rising very rapidly now?
Yeah, well, you can trace it back to 1971 when we broke the final link between gold and the world's fiat currencies. You know, it used to be that money was a real thing. You know, it was gold. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to, say, wage a big war or radically increase some kind of social spending or pretty much anything else that cost a lot of money, you had to go out and get gold somehow. And it's not easy to do that. You have to dig it out of the ground. And, you know, traditionally we get about 2% more gold each year by doing that, which limits the supply of that kind of money. Mm-hmm. And so we had low inflation for most of the past several centuries because the supply of the base money, gold, was only rising at 2% a year. In 1971, we did away with that. Governments wanted more flexibility to be able to massively increase military spending, for instance, in the case of the U.S., or to dramatically increase entitlements, also in the case of the U.S., but also everybody else in the world. And so they did that. Now, the central banks at that point, when they have pure fiat currencies, are armed with, you know, effectively unlimited credit cards. They can make as much new currency as they want to. And so since the time that we became pure fiat currencies, the central banks have intervened in the markets using this unlimited printing press to distort normal market mechanisms. You know, we started with the bond vigilantes here. They basically shut down the bond vigilantes by creating trillions and trillions of dollars and euros and yen and buying back bonds with them, which pushed the price of bonds down, which means it doesn't matter if the markets are a little bit skittish about inflation and they're selling their bonds. The central banks are there to buy them at ever lower interest rates, at ever higher prices. And gradually, people have gotten used to that. They started to think that that's the new normal in the world, where central banks basically just control what used to be free markets. And so stocks will always go up, home prices will always go up, bond prices will always go up, which is to say interest rates will always go down, or at least they'll stay at really favorable low levels. So why not borrow as much as you can get a hold of? You know, if interest rates are super low and the Fed is going to maintain stability in the markets, borrow a ton of money, you know, because you'll be able to pay it back at these, especially at these lower interest rates. So the whole world basically has gone on a debt binge since then. And that's how they've been able to get away with it. We think the central banks are omnipotent, that they can maintain 2017 levels of financial stability forever. But what we're finding out lately is that maybe that's not true. You know, all of a sudden, the stock market is bouncing around really dramatically. Bonds are starting to go down pretty hard as interest rates go up. You know, we're down, I think, about 270 points on the Dow today, Jay.
Right. As we're talking. I noticed.
And you know, 3 months ago, a 270-point move on the Dow would have been really remarkable. It would have had people, you know, sitting up and paying attention. And now it's like, oh, you know, it's not even 500 points and certainly not 1,000 points. So it's just, you know, random noise. Who cares? That's how much volatility we've gotten into the market just in the last couple of months. And that's how quickly everybody's gotten used to this volatility.
Right. Well, let's explore some of the ways and some of the reasons why the Fed may not be omnipotent and omniscient, why, in fact, there may be some limits to what the Fed can do and how far they can manipulate markets, why it is maybe, just maybe, that the natural laws of economics have not been overcome by, you know, these brilliant guys from Princeton, Harvard, and Yale that that run our country and run our banking system. What are some of the reasons? I mean, one of the things I can think of right away, John, is that you have malinvestment that's caused when you don't allow the capital to be priced correctly, when you don't allow price discovery of capital, you push the price of capital down, then you have something the Austrians refer to as malinvestment, when money goes into all kinds of things that don't make really any economic sense. Is that one of the problems that the system is going to be facing now? You have all of the all of this capital put into places that don't really provide great returns.
Yes, the short answer is emphatically yes. What happens when you make money too cheap is that people misread the signal that you're sending. You know, mm-hmm. if banks want to lend you money at extremely low interest rates, normally that's kind of energizing, right, for anybody. And your tendency is to say, well, you know, if they think I'm such a good credit, let me borrow this money and I'll find something to do with it. So you get the whole world basically doing that when everybody's pushed interest rates down to really low levels. And then you get things like in China, for instance, ghost cities, where they build entire cities because they have access to the funds at very cheap rates. Mm-hmm. And nobody lives there now. You know, and the same thing with airports and highways. They went on this infrastructure building binge over the last decade, which caused them to quintuple their total amount of debt in the system. And they probably didn't get a good deal because they built a lot of things that will never generate the kind of cash flow necessary to pay off the debt. And that's true everywhere. If you look at, for instance, the corporate sector in the U.S., corporations have borrowed record amounts of money. But instead of doing productive stuff with it, in other words, building a new factory that'll produce something that'll generate massive cash flow and pay that debt off with no trouble, they've been buying back their stock.
Yeah,
we're paying dividends. And so what's happening now is the stock price is up somewhat, which makes the rich people who own the stock and the corporate executives who own a lot of the stock even richer than they were. But you've got this company that's saddled with huge amounts of debt, you know, record amounts of debt, 8 years into a recovery. You know, economic expansions don't normally last more than 6 years. and then there's a recession to flush out all the malinvestment that happens towards the end of a recovery. Well, we're towards the end of one of the longest recoveries ever, and corporations are borrowing record amounts of money to buy back their own stock at record high prices. Now, that you know, you can think through the implications of that and see that that's a big problem for a lot of corporations, which we don't realize. You know, we're not recognizing that in the company's stock price because the stock price is being pushed out up by all the money that companies are borrowing to buy more stock. But once the economy turns down or once interest rates go up and it's no longer a good deal for companies to start or to keep borrowing money to buy back their stock, then that huge buying pressure that's there now will disappear, stock prices will go back down, and these companies will be stuck with all the debt that they took on, but assets in the form of the equity that they bought back that's only worth half as much.
Yeah.
So they're going to be looking at a, you know, 50% loss on what is probably, in a lot of cases for these guys, their biggest activity. You know, buying back stock is the biggest thing they do now. And when that happens, they're going to look like badly managed hedge funds rather than brilliantly managed industrial companies.
Right.
Their stock prices will just go down. You know, it'll be like a death spiral where stock price drops because of the recession. And then we see all the problems that this company actually has laid bare, and we sell the stock some more, and it drops even further. That's out there. That will happen in the next few years.
Yeah, what is the saying? When the tide goes out, you find out who's swimming naked or something like that?
Yes.
So so then you have – and the other thing, John, is that you have this enormous amount of debt. I mean, people – we don't – as you said, we, you know, gold used to be money. still is, but it was legal tender in the United States, and so it was an asset-based money, whereas now it's a liability-based money, so all the debt is still there. It's not, I mean, most of it, I guess, every now and then it goes through bankruptcy and gets forgiven or disappears that way, but for the most part, you have this exponential growth in debt, and then you have the compounding effect of that, and even under low rates now, low rates of interest, you know, I've noticed a chart the other day that showed even as rates were falling, U.S. debt, treasury debt was going up fairly significantly, and now as rates are starting to rise, I mean, can you imagine? Michael Oliver was telling us that he's expecting, his work is suggesting very strongly we're going to see 4.25% on the 30-year. Can you imagine, I don't know, you know, on shorter duration there will be lower rates probably, but do you see, what is this going to mean for the Treasury? And then we have a new guy at the Fed, Jay Powell. What do you think he's going to do? Do you think he'll handle things any differently than Janet Yellen might have or Ben Bernanke when push comes to shove, when we, you know, as this rate rises, as rates rise, which I think they inevitably will because there's a shortage of capital to meet the enormous amount of indebtedness that our government is piling up. How do you think, do you have an opinion on how Jay Powell may handle this and you know, what do you think the outcome is going to be here?
Well, whoever's running the Fed, first of all, they all come from the same pool of people,
right?
Who talk every day and who agree on everything. So what the new Fed leadership will do will be identical to what the old Fed leadership did in the previous crisis, except it'll have to be a lot bigger because the numbers are a lot bigger. You know, we owe way more. So in order to monetize that debt, we've got to create even more currency. So when this happens, we'll see quantitative easing on a scale that dwarfs what we had before. We'll see interest rates go not just to zero, but sharply negative in a lot of the major countries. There was at one point, what was it, $30 trillion or something like that of negative yielding sovereign debt out there in the world.
Yeah.
And now there's much less because interest rates are starting to go up into positive territory. And that is the embedded time bomb in this kind of a system because everybody's deeply in debt. And in a lot of cases, they borrowed very short term in order to get the lowest rate, you know, because short term rates were even lower than extremely low long term rates for the past few years. So you got all these governments that have to roll over trillions of dollars a year, every year, of just their existing debt. At the same time, they're borrowing new money. So if interest rates go up, you get a double whammy. The debt you roll over costs you more, and the new debt that you take on costs more than the old debt did. And so your interest costs start to ratchet up. And we're not talking just, you know, a few hundred billion dollars here or there. We're talking trillions of dollars of new interest costs that are embedded in a system where the long bond does what you were saying. If it goes over 4%, that sounds existentially threatening when you look at the numbers. So there's a number out there, Jay, on the 10-year or the 30-year bond that blows up the system. And we don't know what that yield number is. Maybe it's 3% on the 10-year bond. Maybe it has to go to 4%. If it goes to 5%, the numbers become so forbidding that I think the number is before 5%. But somewhere out there is an interest rate number that blows up the system. And it is probably not that far away based on the amount of debt that we've taken on. So the short takeaway from all of this is that the volatility we've seen lately is just a taste of what's to come. It's going to be much more extreme before this plays out.
And at some point in time, you know, your website is dollarcollapse.com. It's there. You've named it that for a reason. Your view is at some point in time, confidence comes into play. At what point in time do people stop believing that these brilliant PhDs from Princeton, Harvard, and Yale that run our country, run our banking system, are not omniscient, are not omnipotent? When do people, I mean, at some point, maybe when the system blows up, what happens then? And do we, you know, do we run into a hyperinflationary event or a deflationary implosion? What's your best guess?
Well, it could be either of those because immense amounts of debt can lead either way. You know, you could have a 1930s style collapse when we get rid of the debt by defaulting on it, or you can have a Weimar Germany style hyperinflation that gets you out from under the debt by inflating it away. You know, you still pay off your debts, but you're paying it off in currency that's worth, you know, 1/30th of what the original currency was. It's clear that we're going to try to engineer a big devaluation. That's what we're going for now. Everybody's mm-hmm. trying to make their fiat currencies worth less and less each year in the hope that that keeps them ahead of their mounting debts. The huge danger there is that people figure it out. You know, once everybody realizes that it's the policy of the government to make the money in their bank accounts and the money in their wallet and under their mattress and buried in the tin can in the backyard worth less each year, nobody wants to hold that money anymore. It makes sense to borrow as much as possible and then to convert all that money that you get into real stuff that governments can't inflate away. So the Austrian School of Economics calls that a crack-up boom. And we've created the classic conditions for that to happen. And then it just becomes a question of timing, right? Is it this year, next year, 5 years from now? We can't know that. But we can say with a high degree of certainty that something pretty terrible is going to come from this much borrowing, because we've got 3,000 years of history with absolutely no exceptions in which countries that borrow too much money had a gigantic financial crisis involving their currency. You know, that's happened over and over again. So there's no reason to think that it won't happen this time around.
Yeah. You know, we're just about out of time, but I have to think here that, you know, you're talking about when people figure it out. It right now, it seems like the safest thing in the world. Governments are increasing their money supply to try to beat this thing. And gold is one of the few places, one of the most logical places to go. I guess at some point in time, people lose confidence, then velocity kicks in. Then you could go over to the hyperinflation side, John. We're 30 seconds. We're out of money. We're out of time here.
Okay, hyperinflation this time around, or mass devaluation, or crack-up boom, you know, whatever term you want to use for it, will manifest as the value of the dollar and the euro and the yen starting to go down big against real things, which means the price of real things will go up. Gold and silver will go parabolic while this is happening. Yeah. $100 up days for gold, $10 up days for silver regularly for a while. Yeah. It'll be fun to watch from a gold bug's perspective.
Yeah, but not a very safe environment for sure. So thank you, John, for being with us today on that unhappy note in a way. But it's always good to have you with us to get your thoughts on these very important issues. So thanks very much for being with us. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Dr. Quentin Henning of Novo Resources will be with me. Alistair McLeod is scheduled to be a guest. And with a little bit of luck, we'll also have Michael Oliver back with us. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.